Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You can't say he didn't warn us. For nearly a decade, investigative reporter Stephen Emerson has been on a crusade to warn America and the world about the growing danger of Islamic terrorism. Then came 9/11. Now he says America remains home to hundreds, possibly thousands, of Islamic terrorists. In this hour, Stephen Emerson sounds the alarm on the threat in our own backyard. Is this crusade stirring awareness or hatred? Begin this hour with the latest developments in Afghanistan. U.S. troops have stepped up the fierce ground battle against al-Qaeda and the Taliban forces. Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Army. Earlier, I asked him why it's been such a tough fight in the mountains.
Well, it's a tough fight because the people in the mountains are well-armed, they're well-organized, they've had quite a lot of time to prepare themselves. And, of course, the climate there at the moment is against security force operations. So it's very difficult for the Americans, their coalition allies, and for the Afghans on the ground to actually get into the very, very hilly, very, very high area in which the Taliban fighters have managed to secure themselves.
But we had come, I think, to see the Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters remaining as on the run, as bedraggled, and here they are dug in, apparently well-armed, and repelling it, reportedly, the first wave attack by U.S. and other forces over the weekend entirely.
Well, it's a long story, and I've been trying to get this through to people since before Christmas, that the Taliban literally moved out of Kabul under their own steam and not exactly under their own timetable. But it was quite obvious that they had decided that they couldn't hold ground under the threat and the imminent destruction of U.S. air power and the targets being marked by special forces. I mean, they were being destroyed in large numbers on the ground. And they realized that the only way that they could keep themselves going was to disappear to the hills and fight the same sort of war that they fought, say, against the Russians in the 1980s. So they managed to get away from Kabul and then after that from Kandahar with an awful lot of equipment and a lot of ammunition. And obviously they have spent the last 2 months, nearly 3 months, regrouping, retraining, and getting themselves organized for, I think, quite a long guerrilla campaign. And remember that there were at least 30,000 Taliban fighters in the field in September, October. Now, I think that we can probably account for about 10,000 either captured, wounded, killed. Leaves around about 20,000. And of those 20,000, obviously there's going to be quite a lot of fair-weather friends who will have disappeared from the Taliban order of battle. But even if we try and drive those figures down as far as we can, it still looks as though the Taliban might have around about 10,000 people in the field, probably away from the main centers of population, up in the hills, and waiting for the weather to get better before they start making too much of a move. I think what's happened here is the U.S. and its coalition allies have actually gone after these guys in the hills in this particular instance and in this particular place based on the intelligence reports they're getting. But there are bound to be other pockets of al-Qaeda, well-armed, and they're going to take quite a long time to remove. There's no doubt about that.
If you're talking about perhaps 10,000, and this effort has been to rout out, we're told, as few as 200 or 300, though the numbers are unclear, it makes it sound like a significant challenge still lies ahead.
Well, I would say that almost certainly the guys that are under attack by the U.S. and its coalition forces at the moment, they're not going to stay there and try and hold ground. What they're going to try and do now, having inflicted some casualties is to move off and get into another area, hunker down, and live to fight another day. If they stay there, if they try and hold ground, they're going to be destroyed by U.S. aircraft, and they know that. So we will probably see over the next few days what appears to be a crumbling of resistance, and then coalition forces moving in and mopping up. But in fact, the main part of that force will almost certainly try and escape and move away.
You've said that you see them trying to turn to a guerrilla campaign, perhaps along the lines that they've mounted against the Soviet Union. What are the risks of a return to a Soviet-style quagmire here?
There are risks there. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. I think that the Pentagon is well aware of those risks, and the way they've fought the campaign so far has very cleverly tried to avoid those risks. Now, whether they can avoid those risks in the long term remains to be seen.
Well, Charles Heyman, what should we look for? How will we know whether we're wrapping this up or descending into a long-term bloody engagement?
Well, we'll know that we're wrapping it up when Mr. Karzai's regime in Kabul starts to project its government's power all around Afghanistan. Until that happens, I'm afraid this is not going to be wrapped up. And there are an awful lot of warlords running around and doing their own thing. And all over the south, I think there are some quite large pockets of Taliban. So this is a real difficulty for the long term. I think one of the things that the U.S. is trying to do and the British are trying to do in Kabul is put together some sort of Afghan national army. But if you try and support that army into the long term, I mean, that's a big risk. The only thing I can say for certain at the moment, I think, is that this campaign is going to run for much, much longer than anybody thought. And there'll be quite a lot of coalition troops there for some months to come.
Is there a danger of anti-American, anti-Karzai forces actually gaining in number over time?
No, I think that there is a danger that the Taliban faction will increase. That danger could be reduced, I think, by some prompt payments in from the international community so that people on the ground see that if they stay on side with Karzai, then there'll be all sorts of economic benefits that Afghanistan might see quite quickly. If that money doesn't appear quickly, then I think we've got a real problem on our hands. Well, I spoke to someone yesterday. He said the police in Kabul are still not being paid. Well, if you're not paying your police force, I mean, that really is a serious problem, because those guys are not going to be dedicated to law and order. They're going to be dedicated to getting as much money out of the system, out of people's pockets, as they can.
So what's your quick prognosis? How much longer do you, if you had to guess, would you say American forces will be seriously engaged in Afghanistan?
Well, I'd say for at least another 4 months, and the jury's out on whether it's going to be longer than that. But this is not going to be over overnight. There's almost no doubt about that. There may well be a lot of hard fighting to do.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Army. He spoke to us from Shrewsbury, England. Just the title of Stephen Emerson's new book, American Jihad, The Terrorists Living Among Us, is enough to give you goosebumps. Turn the pages and your heart will start pounding. In it, Emerson makes his case that the United States is now home to hundreds, even thousands of terrorists, and it has become a central node in their international networks. Do we all need to pay more attention to who lives in our own backyards? Or is this just an excuse to mistrust and hate our neighbors? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New York is Stephen Emerson. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Emerson.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. And with me in the studio is tonight's guest news analyst, Juliet Kayyem, Executive Director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, formerly an attorney at the Justice Department. Hello, Juliet.
Good evening.
Stephen Emerson, you are such a high-voltage persona. Your defenders call you a prophet without honor and the victim of an ugly smear campaign over many years. Your critics have called you anti-Islamic, anti-Arab, an intellectual terrorist, and so on. You've got a lot of baggage, my friend, and a long history of warning about Islamic terrorism in the United States, and now there stands 9/11, and in its wake, your new book, American Jihad. Take us back. How did you first get into this, what has become, it reads like a consuming interest in Islamic militancy?
Well, the interest goes back to when I was still working for CNN as a correspondent, but let me just, if I can parenthetically just, your high voltage introduction is good. I guess controversy always sells. But the bottom line is, what I've been warning about is the threat of militant Islam, not just to Jews and Christians, but to moderate Muslims. Number two, I always make a distinction between Islam versus militant Muslims, because no one can inherently claim that a religion is violent, and no one can say that about Islam, or can they say about any religion. It's the people who practice it. And so what I look at in the book are those who are practicing a militant version, but particularly those in the United States who are tethered to Islamic militant movements, including terrorist organizations. I don't even make a distinction between militant Islamic extremists versus terrorists.
Somebody
who doesn't.
We are eager to get into all of that, Stephen Emerson. I must say, I think there's never been a clearer case on this show of someone who brings controversy with them. I'm not judging on that front, but there it is. The record is full of it. But our ears are wide open to your case, and we'd like to hear you make it. Where did your interest begin?
It began actually when I was working for CNN, and I actually was sent to Oklahoma City to cover a press conference in December of 1992, and it was actually Christmas Day, and I ended up having to drive downtown looking for a fast food restaurant, and I stumbled across a Islamic convention at the convention center, the Oklahoma City Convention Center, and I was actually astounded to see so many people who were Muslims, betraying my own stereotypes. And I walked in there, and it turned out to actually be an umbrella conference of radical Islamic organizations. People were actually connected to terrorist groups. The head of Hamas was there and making speeches calling for jihad. There were calls of killing Jews. There were radical tapes, audio tapes, videotapes, books, the stuff that you would find from Pakistan, Afghanistan today. But, of course, these were all published either in the United States or brought into the Middle East and being sold there by the thousands. And when I came back to Washington after having witnessed this orgy of rhetorical exhortations of violence, I asked the FBI if they knew anything about it, and they said no. They said they had no idea anything was going on. And, of course, 2 months later, the first World Trade Center bombing occurred. And then I started looking into the groups operating in the United States, which included Hamas and Hezbollah. In fact, the entire spectrum of Middle Eastern groups. And I did a documentary in 94 called Jihad in America, which had videos of these radical groups training, recruiting, or raising funds in the United States. That was why it was called Jihad in America. Mm-hmm. And since then, you know, if you write a book or do a film, 99% of the stuff ends up on the cutting room floor. So I decided to create an archival database of all the materials dealing with militant Islamic groups, because no one else was out there. You know,
Do you mean, Stephen Emerson?
I'm sorry?
You mean no one else was doing that work?
Well, nobody else was collecting it. You know, when a journalist or anyone does a story about any group or individual, they usually go to Nexus and they punch in all the clips to see what's out there. But if there's no audience or a reporter or event that is recorded on tape or in a transcript form, then you simply don't know that it's happened. And here, I was sort of privy to all of the radical groups operating in the U.S., and nobody was recording it for either journalistic reasons. And, of course, the government appropriately was not allowed to go after these groups unless they were violating the law. So I sort of assumed the responsibility myself in the need, I thought, to inform the U.S. public and to alert government about an increasing threat operating on American soil.
Stephen Emerson, you just said something, the government couldn't go after them unless they were violating the law. Do you have a problem with that?
No, not at all.
But in reading your book, I did see some concern on your part that the FBI, it read as though you felt the FBI was handcuffed in the way that it's able to keep track of potential threats that are not over the line of breaking the law.
Well, I did not make a judgment. I said they are handcuffed. They're restrained. But, in fact, if anything, I wrote that there are appropriate restraints on them because we obviously, you know, don't want to violate freedom of speech. That's our greatest protection in the United States. But freedom of speech doesn't immunize someone from the scrutiny of being criticized or being exposed. I mean, David Duke makes a speech. One doesn't expect your station to interview David Duke and not bring up the fact that he just called for, you know, exhortations against blacks and Jews.
That's quite right.
And if he said you're being anti-white, or you're being anti-Christian, you'd say, no, I'm just being anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the same charge that was made against me.
Stephen Emerson, we're going to dig way into this. Juliet Kayyem, first thoughts before we go to a break?
There's something interesting in Stephen's book in terms of what he's assessing. There's a question about what is terrorism. I don't mean it in the sense of is one person's terrorist, another person's freedom fighter. But in regards to Mr. Emerson's book, what is it in fact? Who are these terrorists living amongst us? Is it because they are in fact terrorists, or because, as he says, they are simply radicalized? And in that sense, we're touching upon the sort of First Amendment issues that we'll get into when we later.
We will indeed. There's a lot to talk about tonight with Stephen Emerson, author of American Jihad. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author and investigative journalist Steve Emerson, author most recently of a new book entitled American Jihad, The Terrorists Living Among Us. Stephen Emerson has a long history of going after American Islamic militancy, of exposing exactly what's going on in some of the more radicalized mosques in America. And it's created quite a trail to go with it. All the way back in 1991, the New York Times was describing his work as anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian.
Am
I incorrect, Stephen Emerson?
You're absolutely incorrect.
I'm quoting from a New York Times review of your 1991 book, Terrorist.
Okay, it was, first of all, in the same way the New York Times, it was written by a reviewer in a book review who herself had a conflict of interest, as was I disclosed in a letter.
All right.
It doesn't speak for the New York Times any more than the Abe Rosenthal columns that were written and said I was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Not that I'm saying that I am, but they don't. In other words, it's the columnist or the reporter. The New York Times didn't say it as an institution. Okay?
Well, we're happy for your finer definition.
Because that was exactly what Islamic groups are doing, which is to say they take a quote from a reviewer and they say, this is what the institution said about him.
Well, you know, there are conventions here, Stephen Emerson, that you know well, and I think we're well within them. But I will be happy to have your finer point on it. I was about to go on to say that up against that, we have to look at Stephen Emerson, his own words from May 31st, 2001. That is just a few months before 9/11/2001, where he said Al-Qaeda is planning new attacks on the U.S. Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have silently declared war on the U.S. In turn, we must fight them as we would in a war. And here we are in March 2002, and indeed, we are fighting them as in a war, and 9/11 did happen. It's a very complicated mission you set out on in this country when you go after a particular group, particularly along religious or ethnic lines, with the kind of complaint that Stephen Emerson is pursuing. And Stephen Emerson, you have found in graphic detail just how hard that can be. You gave us some of the history of how you got into this subject. Paint a contemporary picture for us today by your lights, Stephen Emerson. What is the profile of the Islamic militant threat inside the United States? What's it look like?
Well, there are two components to the existence of the militant infrastructure. One is the existence of groups that are tethered, supportive, or front groups for militant Islamic movements overseas that aren't necessarily violating the law. For example, the Hamas organization had a front group called the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development, raising tens of million dollars for Hamas. Its assets were frozen in November, several months ago. But before its assets were frozen and deemed a terrorist front, it was a legitimate, humanitarian, nonprofit group raising tax-free funds for overseas activities. So there has been, you know, rather a change in terms of what the government has sort of thrust into the public domain, number one, which has now looked at various groups, collected the intelligence, and deemed them to be terrorist fronts, as in the freezing of assets. So we are, I guess, in a situation where some of the terrorist infrastructure has been frozen, some of it, the militant Islamic movements are still raising monies through other conduits. They're still having rallies. Just in Chicago in December, there was a Hamas convention where thousands of people, or 1,000 people, were, you know, meeting to support Hamas. you know, exhorting followers to carry out, you know, radical, you know, behavior. Not necessarily illegal. In fact, I would say it was thoroughly protected. But certainly, stuff that's going on here, it shows the difference of values that these people have with U.S. I mean, what I wanted to show in the book was what's going on in our backyard on the part of radical groups. And I've written books back in 1988, 89, 90. I wrote a book called Fall of Pan Am 103, the downing of the crash over Lockerbie. So I've had a long interest in terrorist groups. Where this is a more complicated story is because, as you just appropriately pointed out, there's a religious component. And so these groups hide under that mantle of being religious or humanitarian and claim that anyone who exposes them is being anti-Muslim. What I think you can see is that when a group called the Council on American Islamic Relations hosts a rally where they call for jihad against Jews or, you know, raising jihad or death against Jews, then I think we have to raise the question, what does this group want? Now, I'm not suggesting at all, again, that they violated the law. That's up for the government to decide. But I can tell you, for years, I warned about, for example, the humanitarian front groups that were set up in different cities, including Boston, raising money for terrorist organizations. But because the government didn't deem it terrorist groups, they were legal. Now that the government has moved against them, it looks like I've been vindicated. But I haven't changed my message. The people looking at it have come to me and say, now tell us what you have. We understand the threat is much greater than we ever anticipated.
Stephen Emerson, of course, there's a long history of American citizens supporting causes overseas that might or might not be in line with Washington's policy. What is your view there? Do American Muslims have a right to express anger and opposition to U.S. policies without being branded a terrorist threat?
Yeah, I don't think that that's the issue. That's a red herring.
Well, it's an honest question.
No, of course, but it's a red herring. In other words, opposition to Israel, I mean, nobody is disagreeing. And certainly, I mean, the problem here is that the groups that I've been tracking aren't just saying we oppose Israeli policies. They're saying death to Israel, yay, yay, Hamas, and we support terrorism. We buy paradise with the barrel of a gun. Now, again, that doesn't mean that they are engaged in terrorism. They have every right to say it. However, they are not immune from the scrutiny that needs to be applied to them any more than David Duke or Louis Farrakhan should be immune from scrutiny about their racist statements. Mm.
Juliet Kayyem, your career is devoted to issues of domestic preparedness. Stephen Emerson describes in his book, quite fiery pamphlets, brochures, videos, and so on that come out of the American Muslim community. On the other hand, we've seen American Irish and many other groups over the years, including American Jews and their support of Israel, be very fiery. Is this a fair characterization of the threat coming out of this particular group?
Well, I guess I should go to where Stephen Emerson seems to be alluding to. I mean, he says that we should scrutinize these groups for what they're saying. And he's an investigative reporter. That's what investigative reporters are supposed to do.
So lay it out there.
Exactly. And I don't think anyone would have problems with that. It is the inferences or the analysis that comes out of that scrutiny that is somewhat troublesome, I think, from the perspective of not just people in the Arab and Muslim community, of which I, you know, full disclosure, I am one, but also people in the counterterrorism community, which I'm also one, in regards that groups like CARE, which Mr. Emerson mentioned, HLF, the Holy Land Foundation, American Muslim Council, which he mentions in his appendix, to argue that these are, as his title says, you know, the terrorists living amongst us, is not only, I think, a broad brush for sort of maligning these groups for maybe statements that individual members made, statements that people who spoke before their conferences made, but these are groups that also do work that your average, you know, grandmother in Dearborn, Michigan supports, you know, helping, orphanages or whatever. So there is scrutiny. I don't have problems with scrutiny. It's the inferences he's making, and he opened up, Mr. Emerson opened up discussing with you, Tom, you know, that controversy sells. And I think Mr. Emerson knows that. He knows that to say that the terrorists live amongst us, sort of equating all of these groups with terrorists based on their radical or radicalized statements, I think is an incredibly broad brush. From the perspective of law enforcement, the question then is, if these groups are living amongst us, why has there been so few cases, so little going on, even post-September 11th? So I want to present the alternative viewpoint here.
Before we turn that back to Stephen Emerson, and Stephen, we will turn it back to you in just a moment, but I want to ask you, Julia, from your perspective as someone who follows national security, how would you judge the threat of Islamic militancy inside the United States today?
Well, I think it's likely that there are some people here, and I'm not even going to affiliate them with groups, who may be terrorists, who may have gotten in.
But do you mean Muslim?
Islamic terrorists,
that's what I'm asking about.
That may have gotten in on visas. We know that the visa problem is an issue that we need to watch out for. That's why the law enforcement approach to this war on terrorism is so essential, that we actually go after these guys before they're able to do anything. And it's not just here in America. As Steve well knows, it's in Spain and Europe. And
is it an acute problem? Is the government focused enough on this? Or I guess let's just be very blunt. Is the government somehow handcuffed by political correctness, as Stephen Emerson suggests?
Let's give the alternative reality here. Since September 11th, over 2,000 people have been detained. None of them, or excuse me, just one, have suffered criminal violations. All those people we suspect, and this is just people in government I've talked to, are Islamic, come from Islamic groups. There's been no criminal charges against them. So there's an alternative viewpoint that you're not going to hear about in Steve's book, you're not going to hear about mostly in the American media, which is we have painted a broad brush here in America. We are going after certain groups, certain religions. And the truth is, we don't know if they're really terrorists, or if there's people whose viewpoints we disagree with, or if they got swept up in the sort of post-September 11th, scariness. And so there is an alternative universe here to the idea that thousands of terrorists are living amongst us. And that is that there are also likely thousands of innocent people who've been swept up in this post-September 11th fear.
Stephen Emerson, how about it? Your warnings are very keen and acute. Are you painting with too broad a brush? Is the U.S. government in the last few months acting with too broad a brush, or not?
Well, I find Ms. Nayem's comments quite interesting, because on one hand, she just said the government should act preemptively to stop attacks like 9/11. And then when the government arrests people, she says, the government's painting with too broad a brush, arresting people because they're Muslim.
They haven't arrested them.
Please let me finish, because I just allowed you to talk. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I think the fact that you said that they're being arrested because they're Muslim, I think is an outrageous comment. Nobody was arrested simply because they had a Muslim name. There were people arrested, the vast majority of whom found not to be connected, only because the government, after 9/11, saw their names either as the same name, were connected in some way on a credit card, on a telephone toll record, in some way were connected. As it turned out, many of them, but there still are people they believe to be al-Qaeda, but they can't prove it. This goes to the problem of prosecuting terrorists who haven't carried out a terrorist attack. That's number one. Number two, the notion that somehow I'm maligning these innocent groups who suddenly, who do wonderful things that our grandmothers do. Of course, John Gotti hosts a wonderful party in Queens or Canarsie, New York, every year for the wonderful community, so that they love him. He's a member of the mob, now in prison, of course, but the mafia does this constantly. It doesn't make them legitimate. Exactly the paradigm by which terrorist groups operate. They held legitimate positions, and they operate legitimate-sounding humanitarian activities. It's the perfect cover. Of course they feed the hungry. I'm not saying Hamas doesn't, but the Hamas hospital in Gaza doesn't have a picture of a child being fed. It has a picture of an Israeli being stabbed to death. It's a recruitment ground. Mm-hmm. And what I'm suggesting here is that CARE, AMC, and other groups provide the ideological support for terrorism. They're not pulling a trigger. They're not doing anything inherently illegal. And it's not up to me to determine that. But if they're going to host a conference or make statements, and it's not just individuals, but the entire organization being associated with, they deserve to be held accountable. Why? If Billy Graham is going to be held accountable for comments he made about Jews 30 years ago, why shouldn't we hold accountable groups that are making comments calling for the death of Jews just 6 months ago?
There's Stephen Emerson. Stephen Emerson, please hold on. And Juliet Kine, a lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. Bob is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Good evening. I have two questions. First, I'd like to know if these groups that Mr. Emerson is talking about, that are the Islamic groups in this country, do they both raise money for humanitarian purposes, legitimate humanitarian purposes overseas, and also raising money for radical militant groups.
Okay, we got that question. And your second, Bob?
The question I have is this. I would like to know why the reporters in this country, especially from the national networks, mm-hmm. have not applied the same sort of scrutiny in their reporting to these Islamic militant groups as they did to the militia groups after Ruby Ridge and Waco and the David Koresh matter.
You mean why haven't the U.S. journalists been as tough on Islamic groups as on other homegrown groups?
Yeah, I can remember whole programs devoted on NBC, ABC, and CBS several years ago to investigating these military groups. People, they characterize them as a group of nuts and freaks. Mm-hmm. And I don't. And with the exception of this program tonight and Mr. Emerson's program and his book, this is the first time I'm hearing about some of these groups, and I think it's pretty frightening.
Bob, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Stephen Emerson. First, Stephen Emerson, do you agree that these groups have had less scrutiny than homegrown American fundamentalist groups,
Absolutely.
Militant groups?
Absolutely. They hide under a religion. Those groups don't. They don't speak English necessarily.
What's your explanation for that?
I think I don't have one silver bullet. I think it's a combination. I think that journalists are intimidated. I think journalists don't want to be accused of the same things that I've been accused of. They're being, quote, anti-Muslim. There's a political correctness. They buy into the victimhood thing. I mean, you know, radical Islamic groups pretend to be civil rights groups, and it's a major deceit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do monitor violations of human rights of Muslims, which is a good thing to do, but it's David Duke monitors human rights violations of citizens, too. I wouldn't give him a moniker of being a human rights activist.
Juliet Kayyem, do you agree that Islamic militant groups have been given a free ride in the United States by the American press?
Not to the extent that Mr. Emerson does. I mean, I think that, for example, we're still waiting to figure out what happened with the anthrax. And there has been, in my sense, a lot less discussion about the possible roots of that than there has been, obviously, for what happened on September 11th. So I think that I think that there is a growing debate. I think that there has been a coverage about these groups. And I think one of the challenges for journalists is that there is a lot of activity with these groups. They are religious groups. They do know they're within the country, working here, raising money here. But a lot of them, as Stephen knows, have never suffered criminal liability. These are not illegal groups. And so in that sense, there's not much of a story.
Let's get one more quick call before the break. Sarah is
on. It's not a story when groups call for jihad in the United States and talk about openly waging warfare against ethnic groups around the world or attacking. It's not a story if those groups are invited to the White House or treated to front page uncritical coverage in the Boston Globe or treated to be meeting members of Congress.
I mean, in that
Julia
sense, Stephen, I just have a question for you, because I read your book, and is there a U.S. Islamic or Muslim group that you think is not a front or is not radicalized? Because I couldn't name
it. You read the book, didn't you?
Yeah.
You see, there's a whole chapter on that.
Well, I mean, who?
You read the book, didn't you?
Well, Stephen Emerson, our listeners would like your answer.
I'm glad to tell them, and they can read more about it, but I called it the Sheikh Hisham Kabbani, the Islamic Supreme Council. Openly, he's an Orthodox Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
He believes in Islam. Islam is second to none. He has openly renounced jihad as holy war. He says we have to acknowledge its existence and renounce it. He has acknowledged the existence of Islamic extremist groups, and he says the Wahhabi ideology has spread throughout the United States. He is a phenomenally courageous man that I think we should be supporting.
What percentage of Islamic groups do you find have that kind of clean hands, in your estimation, Stephen Emerson?
Very few. Very few.
Under 10?
The majority of mainstream groups are tethered to a radical agenda. I will not generalize because there are groups that aren't. But the fact is, the groups that gain the most attention from the media and have gotten the most political attention are the groups that are openly wedded, usually behind closed doors. So there's a great deceit here. Look, it's truth in advertising. I want to know where a group stands before I give it the homage and the respect of calling it a civil rights group.
We've got to take a break. We're going to take some more look at a deeper look at this. Are you persuaded by Stephen Emerson? Do U.S. authorities need to be turning American Muslim communities inside out to root out a terrorist threat? Or is this a new appeal to old prejudice? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Stephen Emerson. He's author of the new book, American Jihad, The Terrorists Living Among Us. He's executive director of the investigative project, described as the largest intelligence and data gathering center in the world on militant Islamic activities. Listeners, is America naive about an Islamic threat within the country, about American jihad? Or do we risk missing peace and making enemies by smearing a whole community? American Muslims, what do you hear in Stephen Emerson's critique? Truth or paranoia? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined now by Sarah El-Fantawi. She's Communications Director for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Good evening and welcome, Sarah El-Fantawi.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us. I have to ask you, have you read Stephen Emerson's new book, American Jihad?
Yes, I have.
And what do you make of the book?
Well, I think it's a collection of half-truths, hate-mongering. I think it's a bunch of scare tactics, and I think it's non-information. And I'll tell you why. It's because Steve Emerson operates from a foregone conclusion on two things. First, he thinks Islam is an evil religion. And second, he thinks that all American Muslim groups are front for terrorism.
He says that he does not think Islam is an evil religion.
Well, I'll tell you, here's what he said in 1995 in the Jewish Monthly. He says, Islam sanctions genocide, planned genocide, as part of its religious
doctrine.
I want
you to know something. Ms. Antawi just made an absolute fabrication. There is no absolute, you tell me, if you can point out, you hear this on the radio, that I use the word Islam in that quote. Okay, you get $10 million, okay?
Well,
the word
okay.
Islam
anyway,
is not in the quote.
I'll
because you're,
to mis-
you're taking material.
It,
no, this is exactly, look.
Stephen Emerson and Sarah, let's just clarify this. Stephen Emerson, I want to ask you a question, if you'll be good enough. What did you say sanctions genocide, planned genocide?
I raised the question that we were afraid to tackle the issue of militant Islam because we were afraid to believe that a great religion sanctions a genocide.
Well, okay?
Doesn't that suggest the same thing? I'm sorry, but
no,
I just...
What I was saying is that we didn't want... The problem is we were conflating the two in our minds. I was saying exactly the opposite.
I got it. Okay.
We're associating
our
charges.
Stephen Emerson, point taken, but I want to turn back to Sarah El-Fantawi. Please, I'm sorry. Please go on.
Well, an article today did quote him as saying that, but that's beside the point. Basically, the situation...
Wait, it's not beside the point.
We've taken the point, though, Stephen, with our short time. Please let us go on. We got the point.
Now, the thing with the book is that he basically bases all of his criticisms of Muslim groups on the rhetoric of a few people. And let me give you an example of some of the things that damns these groups in the eyes of Steve Emerson. For example, the group I work for, the Muslim Public Affairs Council,
all right.
He took one of the leaders, Dr. Hatoud, and he said that Dr. Hatoud said this. Dr. Hatoud criticized the United States government for their bombing of a pharmaceutical company in Sudan.
Okay.
Now, tell me, there is not one, I don't care what you are, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, atheist, there's nobody who doesn't think that the bombing of a pharmaceutical company, which we didn't know was a pharmaceutical company, under the Clinton administration wasn't unconscionable.
That did turn out to be pretty widely condemned.
Of a terrorist front.
You know what? Here's
a
classic case.
The fact of the matter is that Steve Emerson is obsessed
with
Islamic Jihad
and
Hamas, yet there's not a shred of evidence whatsoever that those groups have anything to do with the American people, that they are targeting Americans, that they are on American soil, that they have done anything illegal. Those are groups that occupy in Israel and the occupied territories, and that is Steve Emerson's obsession, and he will go to any lengths to try to tie Islamic Jihad and Hamas to the United States, and he will smear, he will use half-truths, ellipses, anything.
So, Sarah El-Fantawi, I want to turn this back to Stephen Emerson, but one question for you before I do. Stephen Emerson makes the case that moderate Muslims in the United States are afraid to speak out about Islamic militancy because they may find themselves as targets for attack.
It's funny that
true or false.
You asked him earlier to name anyone that's moderate, and he came up with one name, Sheikh Kabbani. That's the only person that Steve Emerson and the Daniel Pipes of the world and all those Islam-mongers
out him?
There.
What did your organization say about Kabbani?
Well, let me tell you. There are
what did your organization tell the listeners?
Well, that's a reasonable question, Sarah El-Fantawi. What does your organization have a position on this particular moderate Muslim by Stephen Emerson's estimation?
I don't think so. So I think he's one person out of 7 million Muslims, and we don't really take positions on every individual Muslim.
Absolutely not true. You issued a condemnation of him. You ostracized him. You demanded that the State Department not invite him.
That's not what we did at all.
What we do is
we focus on the civil rights of American Muslims.
Listen, you issued a condemnation of Sheikh Hisham Kabbani.
We try to help our government weed out the threat of terrorism by legitimate means, by means that target individual specifics and not this sort of scare tactic, hate-mongering, broad brush, non-intelligence that you are promoting in your book for the purposes of promoting your agenda in Israel and the occupied territory.
Sarah Elton-Tawi and Stephen will come right to you. Sarah, I want to thank you for joining us. A lot of callers are going to come in as well, but we thank you for bringing your perspective to the hour. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Emerson, your response.
Well, methinks she does protest too much. In fact, the quote that she didn't reveal that I put in the book was Meir Hatut speaking about the U.S. counterstrikes against Afghanistan for the embassy bombings. And this is the quote I put in the book. And remember, let the quote speak for itself.
All right.
Our country is committing acts of terrorism according to the definition. What we did is illegal, immoral, inhuman, unacceptable, stupid, and un-American. Now, if she wants to say that's simply protesting the bombing of al-Shifa, that's fine. But let readers understand and let listeners understand that's not what she was referring to.
But Stephen, I take even the full quote there, but you don't want to make your case on an Islamic militant threat in America based on American Muslims' condemnation of what was acknowledged to be a mistaken cruise missile attack.
To the bombing of the pharmaceutical. He was referring to the U.S. counterstrikes in general. It wasn't referring to the pharmaceutical strike. It was referring to the bombing against Afghanistan, okay? It was not just a specificity saying, I condemn the bombing of the pharmaceutical plant. It was all about the response, what the U.S. did in 1998. Now, it's not illegal what he did. It's protected speech. But why get so defensive about it unless, if I call what America did is terrorism, okay? That's what bin Laden calls it. Now, you want to take responsibility? Fine. There are other comments I have here. Her group praised Hezbollah for what it did in attacking American troops in 1983 in Beirut. It said that that was a wonderful act of resistance.
Let's hold it right there because we've let her go, and I don't want to get into charge, countercharge. But Juliet Keim, how about the tenor of this back and forth? What do you see here?
Well, I guess the question is the statements that Stephen Emerson just quoted as the member of the Muslim Public Affairs Council said. I mean, how should we take those statements in a war on terrorism that has a 96% approval rating by the American public?
Mm-hmm.
Do people who criticize it, are they terrorists? Are they radical? Or are they just asserting their First Amendment rights? And it's how you want to perceive that criticism. And I think one of the reasons why you get such debates as we had between the woman from the MPAC and Stephen Emerson is that there's a lot of language out there that we can interpret any way, and the First Amendment protects us from saying that. I think Emerson tends to interpret it in a certain way, with that there are terrorists living amongst us,
mm-hmm.
and then people from other communities, I think, are interpreting it other ways, which is there is debate out there about the best approach to rooting out terrorism.
Let's turn to our callers. Jim is calling from Atkinson, New Hampshire. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Good evening.
I just have to note, listening to Sarah, it did seem a little evasive and a little too energetic, her reaction to the critique.
Jim, I take your point. She's very energetic. But if you felt that your entire religion was being assaulted, which she seems to feel, whether or not that's an accurate reading of Stephen Emerson, might it get you excited?
No, because if someone were to criticize a Catholic terrorist, I'd be fine with that. I think it should be based on their actions, not their religion.
Fair enough.
I'd be the first to go after Stephen if I found something in his argument that I thought was offensive in some way,
mm-hmm.
in for freedom of people's expression and their rights.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like maybe the pendulum has swung a little too far into the field of political correctness, and that it may be dangerous right now for journalists to explore whether a particular ethnic group is doing things, and I think it's a dangerous.
Do you think so? Even after 9/11, Jim, isn't there a fairly high appetite to know what's really going on now by your lights?
I get your point, and I agree with it to a point, mm-hmm. but I just think that we're so cautious about looking at people based on ethnicity that mm-hmm. it's still dangerous right now for journalists to go too far into that. And I think that's a very strong part of what we stand for. But if it ends up costing 200 or 300 or 1,000 lives, then we really have to look at that balance.
Jim, thank you for your call. Stephen Emerson, what's your take on how forthright, how aggressive the American media is being today, post 9/11, in its assessment of internal security threats in the U.S.?
I think they're being a lot better because, and so is the government. I mean, everything changed on 9/11. You know, my message and my information hasn't changed. I haven't suited it and customized it to fit 9/11. The caller is right. The journalists are still afraid, however. The killing of Daniel Pearl by Islamic militants. Look, as the book shows, I myself suffered endured a major death threat for which I still have to live, you know, undercover. And the fact is, the groups, you know, that I outline in the book all use the argument that that young woman just, you know, raised on the air, that it's just anti-Muslim, that it's just going after Muslim community. You know, even the way you set up the question, is it hate-mongering or is it accurate prophecy?
Well, people, you know, really want to make a distinction, don't you think?
Yeah, but exactly it. I mean, but you're making the point, but you're putting in that category. If I were to write a book about the Ku Klux Klan, would you, and say, this is the hate-mongering that goes on in the community there, and the radicalism, okay, among, you know, white racists. Would you then phrase the argument saying, oh, you know what, is he hate-mongering against whites, or is he really saving
us? Well, if you wrote that book in such a way that people were wondering whether you were really going after all Christians or all white Christians or however you like it, then perhaps that question would be raised. And you know, we know how difficult this is. You know how difficult this is. Right after the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, your comments were interpreted as inferring that it might well have been an Islamic bombing, and of course it wasn't. So we know it's not easy. I mean, we don't want to be.
Certainly, but that's that, you know, the difference between what we know now and what we knew then is a difference in the world. I mean, the point is the book doesn't say all Muslims are terrorists and every single Islamic person, every single Muslim is an extremist. It makes the point to saying the vast majority of Muslims aren't. And it goes into specifics. It gives quotes, footnotes. So in other words, here's the problem, is that when you present the facts like I have, the reaction is defensiveness or just projection of their own extremism, which is to say, this woman accused me of all these crimes, I mean, these moral crimes. In fact, that's her group's, in fact, guilt. I mean, that's what they engage in.
Well,
extremism and tarring.
Well, we take your point, and we're trying to acknowledge the concern that surrounds this line of inquiry and consider the line of inquiry at the same time tonight. Our time's growing short, but Stephen Emerson, what is your prescription to deal with this problem?
Well, you know, I don't have. I think, one, that we have to embolden genuine Islamic moderates like Sheikh Kabbani and others and give them the legitimacy they need. The Ku Klux Klan was defeated because we denied them legitimacy in conjunction with good law enforcement. Number two, I think the media's got to do a much better job of scrutinizing these groups. They can't get away with allowing them to pretend to be human rights groups. Number three, we have to be willing to, you know, violate the politically correct sanctions and go after groups that claim they're the victims, even though they're not. And the bottom line is Hamas, Islamic Jihad, just the same as the Kahani groups that killed Arabs in Israel. They are terrorist groups. And I don't see Jewish communities, leaders worldwide, getting defensive about condemning Barack Goldstein. The fact is, Islamic Jihad, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda all have to be condemned with the same fervor that we expect, condemn our own extremists, who also pose a threat. And number four, the last thing is that I would want Islamic leaders to engage in what has been a very positive development since 9/11, a lot more critical self-introspection.
Stephen,
I think that's a very positive development.
Stephen Emerson, we thank you for coming on tonight and sharing your view.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Emerson is author of American Jihad, The Terrorists Living Among Us. Juliet Kayyem, final thoughts.
His last point, I think, is a good point to take away, which is that September 11th, I think, has brought a tremendous debate within the Islamic and Arab community about their role and terrorism and politics and international development and all those sorts of things. It's a much more public role, which I think is great. But the idea that we would link groups like Hamas with some of the groups that he does attack in his book, and and I urge people to look at it, like CARE and Holy Land Foundation. The number of times that he's mentioned the KKK, if that were a synonym for some of these Islamic or Muslim groups, may not only be factually incorrect, but it's highly offensive to those of us, I think a lot of people in the community, who love America as much as non-Muslims.
Juliet Kahn, thanks so much for being with us tonight. To read the first chapter of Stephen Emerson's book, visit our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.